Last case this morning is United States v. Stout. Is the appellant ready to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Tim Burrows, Major Jack Einhorn is my co-counsel, and together we represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Norman Stout. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Adding 300 days, 286 days, or 264 days to a specification is a substantial matter. It constitutes a major change, and the military judge should have granted the defense's request to force the government to comply with RCN 603, paragraph D, and prefer these charges anew. Now, I believe the case United States v. Parker is the most illustrative on this point. That case dealt with a situation in which the government pled to an offense occurring in 1995, and then it proved an offense occurring in 1993. This court found that to be a fatal variance. The disparity between the proof and the pleadings was too much.
2 years as opposed to 280 days.
Your Honor, I believe they both exceed the level of tolerance that this court has normally shown for previous cases in which the reliance on the term on or about has really been the saving grace. And that, as a term of art, typically encompasses a few weeks, maybe a month or two. But once we get beyond that, the government's change from its pleadings to its proof starts to alter the factual fabric of the case.
Captain Burrows, let me stop you for a minute just so I understand. Now, you mentioned variance earlier, but isn't it a different concept? There's a difference between variance and amending. Variance would be at the end when the members come back or the findings come back and they're in variance with what was originally pleaded. Whereas amendment takes place, the issue is that it takes place ahead of time. Right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So this is, I thought your argument is not a variance one, it's taking issue with the amendment.
That's true, Your
Honor. Okay.
Our challenge is to the major change that was brought to the charge sheet. So yes, this is a change prior to the admission of evidence. However, the two concepts are closely aligned. I think they are both two sides of the same coin, which is getting to this idea that a charge sheet, the charging instrument, represents the government's statement. This is what we're going to prove, and then the facts and the proof must match that. Now,
how much time did the accused have post these changes before the trial?
The objection was made as a pretrial motion, Your Honor, so there was some time prior to the beginning of trial.
How much is some time?
I can't remember the exact difference between the time that the court decided the motion and the beginning of the trial. But to get back to this idea of a major change and a variance and why I see...
If he had time to deal with the expansion, how was he, even if it was naughty, how could he be prejudiced? If he had time to, swallow it, digest it, chew on it, and adjust his defense accordingly, how could he be prejudiced?
And that's a good point, Your Honor, and I think that speaks to the difference between a major change and a fatal variance. For a fatal variance, this court's case law requires a showing of prejudice. But when we look at United States versus Reese and the application of RCM 603 Delta, there is no requirement to show prejudice. There is no prejudice requirement in the text of the rule, and indeed there's good reason not to. It represents a policy matter, providing the accused with a right that the preferral process should be respected. And when a trial counsel or a convening authority...
To that point, Captain Burrows, and to Judge Stuckey's point, I thought your position was at the reading the brief was that it's not a notice issue, that if, in fact, the charge or the specification has not been properly preferred, then there's really a lack of jurisdiction for the court to hear the offense.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so it wouldn't be of no moment, then, how much time you had to look at it or to prepare for this, it seems to me.
I agree, Your Honor. I believe that.
Well, thank you for that.
So based on
that. I find somebody agrees with me around here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Based on that, your argument, it would be immaterial that the dates were raised in the Article 32.
Correct, Your Honor. And to be clear, as I review the Article 32, I didn't see any recommendation from the investigating officer to change these dates. At the time that this case was first presented to a court-martial, the government didn't see a need to change these dates. When it came back on remand is when it decided to change them prior to referring them the second time to court-martial.
Counsel, in reading your brief, I had two concerns. One is, if we decide in this case that 286 days is too much, what if we get the next case that's 120 days or the next case that's 90 days? How are we to determine? Are we just going to decide these case by case? Is it an absolute number? I mean, if you suggest that prejudice doesn't come in, what's the end result of this? How many days?
It is a good question, Your Honor. I think the question exists independent of this particular case. That question is still
there. I agree with that.
And so my proposal to that would be to look at the way the offense is charged to begin with. The government has been given a lot of flexibility with the term on or about. It is a charging term and provides them a lot of latitude to adjust the proof that may come up at trial to the pleadings. If the change to the date would far exceed what is normally understood by that term, on or about, well, then it's as if the government is providing a new charge, something that should be preferred anew.
Well, should we say 30 days?
I think that would comport with the way that term has been understood in prior cases assessing it.
Yes, let me ask another question. You know, the older case, the Brown case, suggests that it's not a major change. It is a minor change if time is not of the essence. Was time of the essence here?
It certainly was to the defense, Your Honor. And if we look at their closing arguments, starting at record page 536, 539, 542, the defense emphasized the timeline and the time frame. In fact, that was the beginning salvo, if you will, of their closing argument. So time was important. And if we look at, you know, in a more general perspective, time is an essential element to a specification. If there is no time alleged, there's no adequate notice, the jurisdiction of the court can't be established, the statute of limitations may be a question.
You know, counsel, that's not, as I understand it, what means when time is of the essence. When time is of the essence, it's an element of the offense, like the duration of a desertion, like the duration of an AWOL. To say that it's of the essence, you're saying it's of the essence in every charge, because every charge has to stay with enough particularity when and where and what. That makes it meaningless.
Your Honor, I would submit that the importance would be in the change. If charge fails to state any time at which the offense was committed, well then
it deserves dismissal.
It certainly does. And if the government has the freedom to change that time without any kind of restriction, well, then it hardly adds to the idea that we want courts martial to be not trials of ambush, but cases in which both sides know what's going on. Beyond that, I think the question of time is integrated to the facts in every case. And sometimes it will be more important than others. The Brown case cites an example of a soldier being punished for violating a Sunday blue law. Not sure that is a crime that we're seeing often these days, but there may be several other incidents where you have time being essential to one of the enumerated elements. However, we have to recognize that time is important. If the government can't establish when something happened, well, then it raises the question whether it happened at all. It becomes essential to alibi defenses. It becomes integral to the defense's preparation for a case. And so that determination of whether it is essential is going to vary. But Brown itself recognized that time may be essential. The Army Court's decision seems to suggest that it may never be essential. I think that is providing the government with far more latitude than the Article 30 would allow in the UCMJ. Beyond that, I think there's one other distinction to draw, which is that Brown talks about time having to be essential, but RCM 603 is really discussing about a substantial matter. Now, is there a difference between these two terms? Hard to say. I would submit that substantial matter sounds like a lower threshold. It is a matter. It is substantial. It contributes to the substance of the discussion. Essential makes it seem like without this particular issue, you know, there is a fatal problem there. I realize that may be parsing the words very closely, but...
Kevin Burroughs, let me ask you, do you think a minor change is simply ministerial? In other words, we're changing the... forgot to put the accused middle name in the start in the charge sheet, or called him by the wrong first name, or something like that. Is it purely ministerial, and everything else is substantial, or what's your where are you on that line?
The discussion to RCM 603 paragraph A seems to suggest that, right? It says that a minor change should be for slight changes, such as changing a name, even perhaps a small change in date. Can be a minor change, but 300 days is substantial.
Should it matter why the government made the change, and if so, why did the government make the changes in this case?
In the event that...
Because, I mean, in Reese, it was obvious why they made the change.
I think there could be cases, Your Honor, where the government's motivation may matter. I don't think that's an essential part of the finding. Certainly...
Why did the government make the change in this case, the changes?
To be honest, Your Honor, I have not identified a reason why. It certainly wasn't a response to the Article 32. I can only speculate as to what they may have.
So in terms of, from your perspective, how this court should craft its opinion in terms of giving guidance to the field, the military judges, the trial counsel, CCAs, and even this court, 10 years from now, let's say another case comes up before this court on this issue, of how much time fits within on or about. In response to Judge Maggs's question, you were using, it seems, two different things. A standard where you pull 30 days out of the air, or then a standard where you say far exceed. How are you saying, from your perspective, this court should craft its opinion so that we all know what we're dealing with here in the future?
Yes, Your Honor. From my perspective, I think the most workable rule would be to say when the proposed change by the government would exceed what would be normally understood as on or about, once it goes beyond the charge date range, that is a major change. And so if we look at...
But how would we define what we would normally consider within the confines of on or about?
Correct. My reading of the case law has been a matter of weeks or at most a month. And I think Hunt would be a case showing that, and there are a few others cited in the brief.
So your position is we should not go any farther than what we have said in individual cases was appropriate. Now, in those cases, we didn't say 3 weeks is fine. We were saying in this particular case where it was 3 weeks, it wasn't a problem. But we didn't define any outward boundary. So you're saying those prior cases should become our outward boundary?
I think they've come to represent the practice. The court is faced with a challenge where we've had cases in which the court said this was an acceptable change or variance. And again, the change in terms of time and a variance should mirror each other. There should be some continuity between those two doctrines. And then we have a few cases like Parker in particular where it was very clear that this far exceeded it. So in terms of defining that middle ground, I recommend the court stay with what it is. And if it isn't acceptable, it doesn't fall within on or about, then it is a major change. It's no longer a minor issue. It's no longer slight. It is changing the nature of the pleading to conform with proof which would otherwise not fall within that specification. Pending any further questions from the court?
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Sandra Ihinga, and along with Major Wayne Williams, I represent the government. This court should affirm the findings as to the specifications at issues because the changes to the date range were minor and did not require referral anew under RCM 603. Despite the change, the parties remained the same. The specifications always alleged that appellant sexually abused his young stepdaughter. The number and nature of the offenses remain the same. The specifications always allege single acts of indecent liberties, sodomy, and abuse of sexual contact. The penalty remained the same, or the penalty exposure remained the same.
So your view is that it didn't really change the nature of the offense, basically, which is one of, it didn't change the nature of the offense, so therefore it has to be a minor.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what if it was 5 years difference? Based on the principles you've just laid out, that wouldn't be a problem either. That would fit within on or about 5 years.
So, to answer Your Honor's question to appellant as well, this court can emphasize the need to narrow, and certainly that would be the preference, is to offer a more narrow time frame as to what might happen when a specific piece of misconduct happened.
Okay, let's get to that in a minute. But my question is, why, based on the principles that you just laid out, 5 years wouldn't be fine also? Mustn't there be something else out there in your calculations to prevent 5 years from also being okay? And if so, what is that other criterion?
Yes, Your Honor. So it is not the government's position that a change in the date range could never be a major change. And certainly what is a major change cannot be determined in a vacuum. It must take into account the context of that change as well. So changing from, say, for example, taking our situation here from perhaps a couple of months to a year-long time frame may be a major change where that implicates the statute of limitations, where it changes the age of the victim such that an age aggravator is added.
Is that how you think we should craft an opinion in terms of giving guidance to the field, so to speak,
yes,
in terms of what they should be looking at to determine whether it fits within on or about, statute of limitations issues and things like that? Isn't that really going to expand on or about into a creature that is unrecognizable? I guess the question is it so wrong to apply a common sense approach and just say minor? It says minor. 9 or 10 months isn't minor.
I'm sorry, is or is not minor?
Is not.
Yes, Your Honor. So certainly the government would espouse a common sense approach, and I think we can do that here as well. What we're looking at is a change from a few months, and certainly adding a substantial number of days does not a substantial matter make. A substantial matter speaks to misleading, perhaps precluding or adding a defense, as in United States versus Reese. Adding things that were not present before. So the statute objectively says, if you're adding an offense, if you're adding a party, certainly those things are major changes. But then the language as to substantial matter, the language as to likely to mislead.
Well, if the government changed it, right? I mean, these were charges, these were charges and specifications that at the first go-round, the government agreed to dismiss pursuant to the pretrial agreement, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so then you came back to trial two, right? And elected to modify the charges once you knew that you had to try them.
Yes, Your Honor.
So by definition, doesn't that mean that you thought that it was important that it be charged that way? I mean, doesn't that make it a major amendment? Otherwise, why would you do it?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I believe the the actions here taken by the government were to comport with Article 34 in terms of correcting the charge sheet and the specifications to conform to the evidence as it came out of the Article 32. The victim here testified that the acts happened while she was living in Watertown, New York, couldn't remember the dates, but said that her mom would be able to testify as to that.
I know, but my point is the fact that you didn't do it until you knew that you were going to go to trial on these charges, right, I think weighs against your argument now that it was just a minor change.
Your Honor, the initial...
Because, I mean, you were well aware of the Article 32 investigation when you went to the case where he pleaded guilty to some charges and you dismissed others, weren't you?
Yes, Your Honor. So I have not seen...
And then and just a related question, like why would you not have just agreed to go back and re-prefer the charges, have another Article 32, see if you could get him to agree, perhaps have another pretrial agreement to waive an Article 32, et cetera, rather than create this mess?
Yes, Your Honor. I have not seen the record of trial as to the initial guilty plea, and I believe that that's why the changes weren't made to the initial charge sheet, because there was a negotiation process that happened between preferral after the Article 32 and the referral and then the guilty plea.
Well, the problem, obviously, was the girl, the putative victim, had no idea when it happened. She just said it happened when we were at Fort Drum. So all the government did was to cover the whole period they were at Fort Drum. Now, my concern with that is, you know, basically they only lived there for a year. But your average PCS is more like 3. So what if you have a situation where the putative victim says, well, it happened when we were at Brooks Air Force Base, and that was 1971 to 1974, and the government does out to cover 3 years. That's not major. I mean, that's the principle you're defending. That's the action you're defending.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. The principle I defend is the idea that a substantial matter is determined based on the context of the change, given the procedural posture of the case, given the facts of the case, given the nature of the specifications. And United States versus Brown talks about the date range not being essential, especially in cases that involved United States versus Parker as well. It talks about in rape offenses, in lewd acts.
Isn't it essential if prior to the change it didn't cover the entire time that shit might have happened and after the change it did?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of this.
Prior to the change, it didn't encompass the entire time period during which the victim alleged it might have happened, and after the change it did. So why isn't that an essential time period?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, Your Honor, so here the time frames that were initially charged were within that year-long time frame as well. But
they weren't broad enough to encompass the entire period.
As to the original specifications, Your Honor?
The original specification said from this short time to that short time, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You agreed to dismiss those charges pursuant to a pretrial agreement. Then you go back to trial and you have to actually prove them, right? Her testimony from the Article 34, if I understand things correctly, encompassed a broader period of time.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you changed the charge sheet to encompass that broader period of time.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why isn't that an essential change?
It certainly is a change in terms of, is substantial in terms of the number of days. So it might have affected.
Well, substantial in terms of now you might be able to prove it, and before then you might not have been able to. Because before you had a short period of time, at trial she's, and I haven't read the trial transcript either, at trial she's going to testify, I'm not sure it happened sometime at Fort Drum, right? The defense counsel goes up and says, well, you know, it didn't happen during this period. You know, she doesn't know, and they've only charged this period, and they were at Fort Drum this other period, right? And so it falls outside of the charge sheet. But now you've amended it, so it falls within the charge sheet.
Yes, sir. So certainly does it.
I mean, do you understand my point, my question, whatever it is?
Yes, sir. I believe I do, Your Honor. So if I'm understanding correctly, the changes that we have here were to comport with the Article 32 evidence. It is it is not the government's responsibility to ensure that the appellant has a successful defense, only that he has notice of that against which he has to defend. The government's responsibility, in fact, its job, it can be to create a specification and a presentation of evidence that precludes any and all defenses by the appellant.
Now, the government's responsibility is to refer charges to an Article 32, to prefer charges, have them referred to trial from an Article 32, not to change the charge after the Article 32 if it's a major amendment. And so I'm asking you to explain to us why expanding the time frame to the extent that you did in this case isn't a major amendment.
It's not a major amendment, Your Honor, because it does not add a substantial matter and is not likely to mislead.
Okay, so we're going back. I understand.
Well, the government basically is, correct me if I'm wrong, but the government seems to be writing temporality out of the definition. If it's temporal, it's not part of the definition and can never be major. Is that what the government's doing?
Certainly not, Your Honor. In situations where the changes to a date range...
Well, I mean, leaving aside where it's part of the elements of the offense, like the desertion example.
Sure. Or, say, for example, if we change it and it's outside or brings it back within a statute of limitations, or changes the age of a victim, or creates some sort of strict liability offense. Certainly those changes to date ranges would be major changes.
But that goes back to the point I raised towards the beginning of the oral argument here. How, using that criteria, could we not find ourselves confronted with a situation where it's 5 years? You seem to be taking the approach in response before of, we know it when we see it, but that provides guidance to no one. So what exactly are you saying we should be citing, in our opinion, to provide clear guidance about when, beyond the things you've already articulated, once you get past a certain point, it is more than a minor change?
I pause, Your Honor, because the statute does not contemplate a bright-line rule. It does not contemplate this court saying 30 days is too much, 3 years is too much. It really is looking at the context of a change, looking at the context of a change to a date range, and saying this changed the legal playing field for the accused so much that preferral anew is the remedy.
Or should we say, organically, a common law, so to speak, has developed over the years, where about 3 weeks is the window in which on or about still makes sense.
Yes, Your Honor, but if we're taking that 3-week time frame from a fatal variance sort of case law approach, the underlying legal concern for fatal variance is very different from that which underlies RCM 603. Fatal variance goes to a double jeopardy problem, which is also present in 603, but it also goes to a factual legal sufficiency problem, where RCM 603 speaks to notice, an opportunity to prepare a defense, and that double jeopardy issue. So the analysis isn't necessarily, it doesn't come full circle in terms of answering the question. So if we're going to take that 3-week time frame from fatal variance law and apply it to 603, what ultimately may be a substantial matter isn't necessarily a major change for purposes of RCM 603. We must look at the context of the change in order to determine what actually happened here and how the legal playing field for the accused was affected.
Well, yeah, and I'm looking at the context and I'm seeing a situation where once the government has to try the case, they change the spec. So, I mean, the context of this change isn't very helpful to you. It seems to me.
So if we turn to the underlying legal concern for RCM 603, the notice and opportunity to present a defense, and the jurisdictional problem, we don't have any of those issues here. Appellant had notice of the nature of the offenses and the time frame for the offenses as of 2011 when the Article 32 happened. There were 9 months between the referral of charges and trial here. And to speak directly to appellant statements about alibi and whether or not that defense was precluded, in any case where presence is required for misconduct, alibi is available. And the mere fact that it's made more difficult by a larger date range does not mean that a substantial matter was added. It merely makes the defense certainly more difficult for the appellant. But to be clear, the date ranges can have a substantial effect and can be a substantial matter. And ultimately, the fatal variance law that appellant cites to is unhelpful in terms of determining what may be a major change for purposes of RCM 603.
Captain, can you tick off kind of in a laundry list form what you consider to be the context, the factors included in the context, as you've indicated earlier, that make this a minor change? I know it's kind of a summary, but I have been sitting here listening, but this would be easier for me to understand.
Yes, Your Honor. So to go through kind of the language of RCM 603, certainly if the parties remain the same.
No, I'm talking about in this case. You said that you have to look at the context in determining whether date changes fall within or outside the on or about language. And in this case, I think you've alluded to several things. Can you kind of, in a summary fashion,
sure,
check those off?
So the procedural posture of the case is probably important here. We're at pre-referral, and certainly that can have, as we move along, perhaps something may become more substantial or perhaps more likely to mislead an appellant. The nature of the offenses, the nature of the change, and certainly in terms of whether or not to speak to appellant's argument about sort of whether or not this is slight error that can be corrected, this court in United States versus Reese spoke to the fact that even a change in the modality or manner in which misconduct was completed could, under the certain circumstances, be a minor change.
Well, your view, that's not what's going on here.
This is certainly a minor change. There's no change to the modality or manner of the misconduct here.
What about the motivation? And this goes back to what Judge Ryan was getting at earlier, and I think possibly to some extent Judge Olson. The motivation of the government for making the change, isn't that one of the things that should be included on the list when we talk about and consider the context in which this kind of change is made?
Yes, Your Honor, certainly that can be considered, and if there is any measure of bad faith, then certainly
not necessarily bad faith. I'm not suggesting bad faith at all. I'm just saying what the motivation was.
Right.
It need not be bad faith.
The motivation here is to comport with Article 34 to make sure that the specifications conform with the evidence as presented at the Article 32, Your Honor.
Okay.
Here, that correction was made pre-referral, and the charges, as amended, were always before the court-martial. And all the way through, and they're exactly the charges for which the appellant was found guilty. So.
And you answer, I guess you answer Judge Ryan's concern, and to my concern to some extent, is that it doesn't matter the fact that they didn't do it earlier because they knew they weren't going to have to go to trial, and the fact that they now decided to go to trial, they now know they have to expand the time frame. What was your answer to that concern that she expressed? In other words, way back when you had knowledge that these offenses would need to be expanded, the time frame needed to be expanded, but they weren't. Is it because it had already been decided you weren't proceeding on those offenses, or what? And should that be included in this list of factors?
In a general list, it may be included, Your Honor, but here the specifications, and certainly because that record of trial is not available, but because there was a guilty plea, and those charges fell off of the charge sheet. The responsibility
But isn't your responsibility to conform the charge sheet to the Article 32 after the Article 32? I mean, it's not supposed to be dependent on what happens in terms of later discussions about a plea agreement, is it? I mean, if your point is we had an obligation to do this, didn't the obligation exist after the Article 32?
Yes, Your Honor, and it would be only speculation on my part as to why that didn't happen, so say, post-referral, pre-guilty plea, Your Honor.
Could I ask one practical question?
Yes, Your Honor.
How much trouble is it to just re-prefer the thing compared to this?
Yes, Your Honor. It might have been the preferred method to do so, but in this case, RCM 603 did not require the government to do so.
Well, I'm not asking you that. I'm asking you, it's not that much trouble. And instead, here we are. Go ahead.
In fairness to you, counsel, you weren't at the trial, were you? The first trial. As I understand, you didn't try the case, right?
No, Your Honor, I didn't.
I understand.
Okay.
Pending any further questions from this board.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have a rebuttal? No rebuttal. In that case, the case is submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the court is in recess pending further order of the court.